In our scripture text today is Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 to 11. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, "See, this is new"? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. How does one escape from the endless cycles of time? In pagan cosmologies, we know from the scriptures how indeed the Christian has that escape, if you will. But in Hinduism, that which we call reality is but an illusion, Maya, they call it, a projection of the real, though it is not real, as the teachers say. In Hindi philosophy, a universe endures for about 4,320,000,000 years and is then destroyed by fire and water. And this process is repeated again and again forever. The cycle is endless. There's no escape from the eternal cycle of time in Hinduism. Buddhism, as well, the universe is pictured as a wheel of life. And upon that wheel, life turns in a great cosmic circle, spun by, as Buddha puts it, resolutions of greed, ignorance, and hatred. He attempted to escape this endless cycle, all of which we observe is eternally determined by a blind fate in Buddhism. That which happens now has happened ages ago in the past, and that which happened ages ago will occur again in distant times to come. The point on the great wheel of life which turns today, at which we are at an intersection, will transpire again in the future in Buddhism. Well, even the pagan cosmology of modern atheistic science is cyclical, too. The Big Bang theory, for example, posits that from an infinitely small particle of matter, a vacuum flux occurred. This is according to Isaac Asimov when he describes this, a popularizer, if you will, of the scientific theory. That vacuum flux caused that microcosm of matter to explode into the universe that we now know. In time, this now expanding universe will contract and implode upon itself such that all matter will contract into this infinitely tiny speck of matter as it once was. Then it will repeat the same cycle over and over again into infinity and eternity. That takes an incredible amount of faith to believe, does it not? Well, I submit to you that there are no exceptions in paganism. Every cosmology of the world without Christ is cyclical and therefore hopeless. It cannot help but be so. All pagan cosmologies fail to account for the infinite personal God of the Bible, as Francis Schaeffer calls him, and thus ineluctably fall into the trap of the endless cycle of time. The Bible alone articulates a linear vision of time. History has a beginning, a middle, and an end. We know this from the Bible. In the beginning, right? Genesis begins. And Paul says, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son into the world. The end of all things is at hand, Paul also says. There is a linear progression in biblical cosmology. There is a way out. There is salvation from the endless cycle of life, the endless cycle of sin and mere existence and death, and a meaningless repetition of all these things again and again. Well, if this is true, what is a class Ecclesiastes doing in the Bible? Huh? Because it seems, at least, to repeat these the cyclical nature of life. Is there no end to them, though, in Ecclesiastes? Do they repeat ad infinitum? What are we to conclude regarding ultimate things from Ecclesiastes? Well, many dare not look at their text today, Ecclesiastes, because they don't want the answers that come out of it. But we will take a look then for the next few weeks into the book of Ecclesiastes. And today, our title there is Vapor. Now, you have a two-point outline in your bulletin if you want to follow along with us. Vapor is our translation of that Hebrew word havel, which is translated as vanity in most of your translations. Well, vapor. When a man looks at the cyclical nature of the natural world, what is he to conclude? All right, verses 1 through 7. First, he'll take a look at the world, and then he'll take a look at human life as well, the cyclical nature of human life, if you will. Now, you remember from 2 weeks ago, those of you that perhaps were not here, we had an introduction where we covered many of the major themes of Ecclesiastes, and I just urge you to consult that. It should be up on our website and consult that to get a greater background for the introduction to the whole book, okay? But the text before us today forms the introduction to this book of wisdom that we have briefly defined as a conundrum. The Oxford English Dictionary defines a conundrum as a difficult puzzle, the answer to which is based upon a pun or whose answer is enigmatic. And we have posited that Ecclesiastes is a book which Solomon put before his sons, who would follow after him on the throne of Israel. How would they develop the wisdom requisite to rule this people? How would they grapple with the questions which would be brought to them in the gate, right? Well, a beginning could be made, though no certainty guaranteed, by providing a set of questions whose answers are not to be easily lifted from the pages before them. And we know this is not certainly guaranteed because of the history of Solomon's sons subsequent to him, right? Starting right out of the gate with Rehoboam, right? Josiah would be an exception. But most of his sons, right thereafter, did not seem to pay too much attention to Ecclesiastes or the wisdom literature in general. It would require a thorough familiarity with previous wisdom literature, and yea, the entire canon of scripture, plus an application to the circumstances before each king. All right? Okay, well, that's good for them. What about us? What relevance does this book have for us? Well, as Dr. Fredericks puts it, I highly commend his commentary to you. He said, one should study Ecclesiastes with the goal of becoming a ruler, quote unquote, who employs biblical wisdom, a ruler whose realm is one's own brief life and its needy and passing surroundings, unquote. That's a nice summary of its application to us. We are commanded to take dominion. This is a dominion handbook, too, by the way. Another reason I chose it. We should become rulers. Study this book as Solomon's sons would have, because we indeed are rulers within our own sphere of influence. A ruler whose realm is one's own brief life. That's the theme of this book. Life is ever so brief, like a vapor. And its needy and passing surroundings. And Solomon begins his labors with a poem here, these first 11 verses, that summarize all he intends to say. Vapor of vapors, says Koheleth. Vapor of vapors. All is vaporous. Now, I just encourage you, wherever you see that word vanity, to begin substituting. I'm going to encourage you to do that throughout the book. Begin substituting vanity, vapor for vanity. Because it's going to make a lot more sense as we go along. This is one of those key vocabulary words that I highlighted for you in our introduction. Habel, it means vapor or breath, and it even sounds vaporous and breathy. Habel, right? Habel. I'll use it instead of vanity because it more accurately conveys what Solomon intends. Everything is so fleeting, so brief, nothing remains at the end of the day. Now, this may seem new to you, novel to you. It is not, actually, in scholarship. This has been long treated over the decades. It's just people have been timid about challenging the prevailing narrative, okay? As Dr. Fredericks puts it, and I quote him extensively here, he says, the case for Hebel, meaning temporary, has been made extensively before. Temporary instead of vanity, okay? He goes on to say, no substantive objection has been made against such a proposal. In other words, there's been an undercurrent of scholarship that understands this word Hebel as to be vaporous or temporary or vanishing, okay? But he goes on to say, to entertain the belief that Hebel means transience would essentially destroy the current predominant views of the Old Testament theology and its development, especially within the wisdom literature. See, there's inertia that is challenged by this interpretation. He goes on to say, most commentary on Ecclesiastes sees it to be near the close of Israel's devolving continuum towards cynicism about the late covenantal theology of hope and faithfulness towards God and from God. The conventional correlation between righteous wisdom and God's blessing and between evil folly and God's discipline had supposedly dissolved into a theology of moral disillusionment. Vanity, 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 consequently, right? He goes on to say, however, if Hebel means temporary and not futile or vain, this popular approach is no longer valid. In other words, they'd have to retrench their views on wisdom literature in general, Ecclesiastes in particular. Vapor of vapors, consequently. Vapor of vapors. All is vaporous. There is an unwise or foolish conclusion that many draw from this that Solomon is not drawing. That is, that because all is fleeting or vaporous, all is vain. Therefore, all is useless and meaningless. That's why the negative philosophers and skeptics love this book. Friedrich Nietzsche, David Hume, Isaac Asimov, we mentioned, and even some of the recent atheists like Sam Harris. They all love this book. This is why the word is often translated vanity, as King James has it, or meaningless, as the NIV has it. More precisely, Solomon is declaring that what he has observed is that all is fleeting, temporary, brief. Wisdom will note the inherent frustrations and grief in the brief. There is grief in what is brief. Wisdom will also take note of the blessing and benefits of the brief as well. There are things indeed to be cherished. Chapter 3, verse 13. Everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. So I saw that there's nothing better, as he will say in chapter 3, verse 22. So I saw that there's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Because all is brief. This brevity, as well, is communicated in the Hebrew speech of this speech. Hebel Habalim. Do you hear the breathiness of this translation? Hebel Habalim. Hebel Habalim. Hakol Habel. Vapor, vapor, vaporous, right? Everything is vaporous. That's the, even the sound of the Hebrew communicates this to us. How fleeting and vaporous is the breath of our mouths, and how fleeting and vaporous is the breath of our life. Now, Solomon will note the vaporous nature of much of human activity. Pleasure is vaporous. Youth, especially, is vaporous. Success, wealth, desire, even life itself. But what he studiously avoids is leaping to the conclusion of the fool that it is all vain and meaningless. He does never confirm that. This is of the nature of wisdom literature. He will conclude by saying, Koheleth, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. This he does. It is the opposite of the fool. Proverbs says the fool is reckless and careless. Solomon then poses his thematic rhetorical question, and that is, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? His rhetorical question, what does man gain by all the toil? And he'll have digressions and variations on this theme, but this is the basic question of Ecclesiastes. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun when it is so vaporous? What a coincidence. What a coincidence. I've been up at the farm fending off predators here in the spring. Now that spring has come, not only do we come out of hibernation, but so do the predators on our farm. And I find myself battling, just for a sample. Debbie can confirm this for us. She goes outside and meets half of these predators in the morning. We have to hunt them, shoot them, scare them away, whatever it might be. Trap them, fox, raccoon, skunk, magpie, hawk, owl, weasel, coyote, dog, rat, mice, flickers, all of them love our domesticated animals, right? So I have been laboring, and it seems to go in a giant cycle. It seems we do this every spring. It never changes. What's the sense? What's the use, right? So Solomon poses this question about our labor. I'm sure you can say some of the same things when every year the auditors come and you have to cope with them again. It's never ending, right? What's the use? And note our second recurring theme too here, under the sun. It has a great significance for us. He's throughout the book, he will refer to those things that happen under the sun. There are some key themes to it. That is, the vaporous is found in this life under the sun. It's synonymous with while under the sun or while alive. The place of our life points to its time span. That is, it's very brief. Under the sun also refers to the enduring that is found above the sun by implication. Those things found in heaven are in contrast. That is, they are eternal. Chapter 3, verse 11, for example, says, He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, He has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. So although there will be a cyclical nature to history, which is moving in a linear fashion, there's always the sense that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, as we said in our introduction. Because God transcends what is below the sun. Ecclesiastes, Koheleth, will also say, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Whatever God does endures forever. He perceives this, communicates this to us. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear him. All right? The sun also blesses and curses. Where would we be without the sun? Sun, such a blessing. We live in that Goldilocks zone, right? That cosmologists tell us about, that Too close, we burn up. Too far out, we freeze. We're in that Goldilocks, where the temperature's just right, for the thorough prospering of life. So the sun blesses, but it also curses the sweat of our brow, right? Becomes a great metaphor, the sun does, for God's providence. The sun burnt me and exhausts me while I'm out hunting those predators, but it also warms the earth, causes our garden to flourish, and gives me light by which to provide for myself and my family. And Solomon will note all of these things in the course of his speech, blessings as well as curses. Implicit also in the brevity of our labor is the curse. He said to Adam in the garden, right? Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles. That's another thing that bothers me is the thistles that prop up all. I'm out in the sun laboring year after year after year. They keep coming back. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth to you for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Koheleth faces this squarely and tells us what the point of it all is, what the blessings are as well as the curses, what the limitations are as well as the expanse in God's creation. This is a handbook for dominion. Solomon then contrasts the brevity of all things human with the apparent permanence of all things natural, too. Generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The permanence of that earth is illustrated with the circularity of three elements, right? The sun, once again, the crowning star, labors, he does, the labor in setting and rising. And the tenses of the verb and the circularity of the language communicates to us the labor of all of these elements, too. The sun, for example, the sun labors in setting and rising. Consonant with the theme of hard labor, the sun labors in its east and west circuit. He has set a tent for the sun, Psalm 19 says. We read Psalm 19 today, and we'll sing it as well. He has set a tent for the sun in the skies. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his bedroom, rejoicing like the virile, ready to run his course. It goes from one end of the skies, following its circuit, there to the other end. Surely nothing is hid from its heat. The labor of the sun in the skies. There is also the labor of the winds, right? The ruach. Wind is going to play a large role in Ecclesiastes 2. Do you hear the breathiness of that term? Ruach. Ruach. It means one of three things in Hebrew. It means either a breath or spirit or wind, okay? And depending on the context. Very good. Yes. Depending on the context in which it occurs is how you interpret that word ruach. But it will be placed in contrast with vapor. Wind and vapor, both fleeting, both hard to track down, right? So this idea of the wind, the ruach in its blowing. Well, the compass of the earth's latitude is taken up in the rising and setting of the sun. Its longitude is compassed in the north-south course of the wind, thus sketching all the surface of the earth under the sun, the wind. It, too, works hard, but returns whence it began. Circularity. Well, the waters, then, as well. Third element under the sun, the waters. The waters, as well, labor in their flowing. Observationally, Solomon sees with his eyes that though the rivers flow down from the mountains and into the sea ceaselessly, they never run out, because clouds then drift in from the very same sea to replenish the rivers in the mountains with rain and snow. The circularity of the waters. That reminds me of the winter runoff in Teton Valley. Doesn't always bring blessing, does it? Oh, labor, labor. Work, work. The endless cycle goes on and on. This is the arena in which man labors. Individual rays of sunlight shine each day. Individual gusts of wind blow each day. Individual drops of water flow each day. But they are all forgotten as the ceaseless course of cycles goes on and on. This is paganism writ large, a prescription for despair, but not so for Koheleth. We just need to give him time to unfold these themes. Solomon has made no judgment call yet on the relative value of all this. This he will do as he continues to weigh and study and arrange with great care. Don't expect easy, glib answers. He was not communicating that to his sons. No rule of a just king ever is glib and easy. Will you be transported to eternity by all of this? The artist, the statesman, the general? No, you will not. Not by all of this, hardly. Such is the way of the fool. Instead, will you be dejected to hellish despair, like the philosophers and skeptics and mental patients of the world? Hardly. Not that either. Neither extreme. This too is the way of the fool. Despair or transport. Both are ways of the fool. Koheleth is sober and biblical. What he does have to say, he will unfold for us then in comparing the human circularity as well. That brings us to point two, verses 8 through 11. There's a circularity to human life as well. Vapor. All is vaporous. Comes and goes. When a man looks at the cyclical nature of the human condition, what is he to conclude? What is he to conclude? No glib answers. Well, if you thought that nature gets weary with its cycles of labor, how about us? How many times will I have to track down, hunt down, eliminate, scare off the predators on our farm, huh? We not only make, we maintain, don't we? It's part of our labor. Solomon sounds as if he spent a week on our farm, right? He had the farms of his own, though, as well, and saw all of these things, these labors, again and again. Well, in parallel with the three statements, the three elements of nature, water, wind, and fire, three human senses are contrasted and compared, okay? He's doing this deliberately. He's pulling his words out of his head, not out of a hat. So he compares the three elements of nature with three human faculties and contrasts and compares them. First of all, he says, no amount of speech can be uttered so as to endure. Well, that kind of injures my vanity. That means this sermon will be long forgotten sooner or later, right? Won't be etched in marble. Oh, no amount of speech can be uttered so as to endure. Who says anything that is final? Who says anything that is final? Anything that endures. No one does, right? With the meant to be glaring exception of he who dwells above the sun. Of course, his words are forever. What politician can utter a speech that endures, right? I won't go there. With contemporary ones, right? We all know the contemporary politicians flatter themselves. Well, Nero also fancied himself to be an orator. He flattered himself that his speeches would be handed down from generation to generation, that they would be carved in marble like a mighty victorious general. Can anybody quote anything that Nero has had to say? No, his words have not endured, have they? No amount of speech can be uttered so as to endure. Well, speech. Second faculty, which he compares with water, wind, and fire. No amount of sight can be seen so as to endure. Western science is empirical, observational. Conclusions drawn from the observable world of experience. Yet, when have we seen enough to be certain? Even the act of observation is postulated to have an impact on what we observe. When have we seen enough to be certain, to endure? Just watch an episode of Life Without People. Anybody ever see that series that posits what the world would be like, what the earth would be like without people if we were to suddenly disappear? It's really subtly smuggling in the human extinction premise, because the conclusion is always the world would be better off without us. When have we seen enough, right, to be certain that it will endure? Or thirdly, no amount of hearing can be heard so as to endure. No amount of hearing can be heard so as to endure, to persist, to linger. We listen to sermon after sermon, speech after speech, instruction after instruction, and grow in understanding and wisdom, do we? Yet when we've heard enough, can we really say, this will last under the sun? How many times have you listened to airline safety briefings and remembered, huh? Before takeoff, right? Who knows what to do in case of cabin decompression or a water landing, huh? We've been told plenty of times as you sit there in your seat, right? The Transportation Workers Union did an informal survey, and they found among their passengers, 35% couldn't repeat anything, 30% part of what they heard, and 30% all of what they heard. I'm not sure what happened to the other 5%, but this was their conclusion, the Transportation Workers Union. Well, Koheleth is saying as well, even this speech of Koheleth will go in one ear and out the other with so many people, so to speak. So, no amount of speech or seeing or hearing can be experienced so as to establish anything we do as anything more than vapor. Like mist on the river in the morning. We see that a lot in our Teton River. Like mist in the river in the morning, or vapor floating upward from a pot on the stove. Or seeing your breath on a cold morning. All that we do, this is the sense of temporariness that Koheleth is trying to communicate to us. The things that he's covering here are like that. Your breath on a cold morning. All that we do, including our very existence, appears momentarily and then poof, it disappears. What are we to do? How are we to respond? Well, Koheleth does not relieve our tension just yet. In fact, he deepens the conundrum by paralleling the circularity and brevity of the things of nature with that which is new and remembered in human experience. He says there's nothing new under the sun. As his speech will unfold for us, the new of which he speaks is the nature and product of his labor. The nature and product of his labor. Nothing new there. Is he any different, a creature at the end of the day after his labor? Is he any more righteous, any more moral, any closer to his creator, any more permanent than before he began his labors? The answer comes back a resounding no. No, if his labor under the sun is all he relies on for these things. And he'll draw this out excruciatingly. No. That's why so many people are led to despair. Because without considering him above the sun, there is no enduring nature. It is vaporous. Not vain, but vaporous. Nothing new, Pastor? What do you mean? This was, 3,000 years ago, right? We have supersonic air travel now. We have cars, we have trains, buses that are new. They carry us swiftly to places, don't they? That's new. Well, that's not exactly what Koheleth is talking about. All these new things do is bring us more swiftly to war, to adultery, to drunkenness and corruption and sin. Sure, we have cures for diseases that are new and they prolong our lives, right? That's new, isn't it? That prolonging of the life expectancy. Our lives are extended for a few more vaporous years, perhaps, but what happens in the end? we die, don't we? What do we do with those years as well? We spend them doing the same things we did in Solomon's time and Kohelet's time. We hate God, we sin, we generally add to our condemnation by the same pattern of behavior that we displayed before. It's just extended for a while. We get ourselves in deeper in damnation. Well, Pastor, we have computers. We've got cell phones, like Skype and Zoom, right? That's new. And, of course, that allows us to communicate almost instantly with one another. Yet, what is it we communicate? Anything more exalted than before we had them? Oh, we've got Hunter Biden's laptop. We've got TikTok, don't we? Yeah. We don't do anything more exalted than when we had them, do we? It is this sense that Solomon declares, then, there's nothing new under the sun. Our natures remain the same from generation to generation. What you see before you as a man is substantially what you have had in Kohelet's day. And then he also points out that nothing will be remembered so as to be enduring. Nothing will be remembered so as to be enduring. This is a long and storied theme throughout the Bible. Who remembers? It's called the Zakar motif. Zakar is the Hebrew word for to remember. The biblical understanding is much deeper than our sense. In our lexicon, to remember means to bring back to recollection in the mind, right? To recall to one's memory, and then, oh yeah, and then we go on with life. Well, the biblical understanding is much deeper. Remember the laws and statutes and commands given you this day, the Bible tells us, for example. That is, put them so before you that you act upon them to obey. Or, constantly we see the Lord remembered Noah, for example, and gave him the rainbow that he might remember to be covenantally faithful to Noah and his seed. He remembered Lot and saved him. He remembered David. He remembered his covenant with Abraham. On and on. God so put before himself when he remembers that he acts in faithfulness towards them. Covenantal faithfulness. Remembrance bears the same freight here. Nothing from the past will be so remembered so as to be done that we will issue in permanence, right? What is permanent, even in our world? The rush to tear down and destroy statues, for example, memories of those who have made us who we are, is Exhibit A of this, right? Who remembers Thomas Jefferson? Who will remember Thomas Jefferson several generations from now at our pace? Who will remember Andrew Jackson? Who will remember Robert E. Lee, his statue torn down recently by a bunch of progressives? Robert E. Lee was more of a man than 100 of these pencil neck, man bun, skinny jeans soy boys who tore his statue down. When a people start destroying statues, they will soon go on to destroy people. That's been demonstrated throughout history. French Revolution, for example, tore down statues of previous monarchs. We had the Reign of Terror. We have Mao's Cultural Revolution, where an estimated 8 million died in Mao's Cultural Revolution after tearing down statues of previous potentates in China. We do not remember, do we? Nothing is permanent, even in the memory, the pantheon of man. What politician remembers, for example, Nebuchadnezzar, so as to eschew his hubris, or David's humility? Who remembers David's humility before God and so govern wisely? Kohelet is trying to provoke his sons to remember. What pastor remembers the greed of Simon Magus so as to eschew it, or Paul's liberality so as to emulate it? What billionaire remembers the parable of the rich fool so as to eschew his behavior, or the parable of the talents, that he might remember and follow the example of ones who used those talents wisely. On and on we could go. It is this kind of remembrance, covenantal faithfulness, so as to act, that Koheleth despairs of seeing endure. And now in the very act of recalling these, I remember. It comes back to my memory, but it is not enough. What the Zakar motif requires in the Bible is to act so as to obey upon that remembering. They're one and the same. And Koheleth tells us that all of these are vaporous, and he will deepen our understanding with him in days to come. He's laying out his themes right now. Why bother? Why bother? If indeed all is so vaporous. Dr. Fredericks puts it like this. He says, Koheleth does not answer these questions immediately. Koheleth does not answer these questions immediately. We should have practiced delayed gratification here, too, not expecting easy answers right away. What am I going to do for the rest of the few weeks if I give you all the answers right away, right? No, we're going to go through this painfully. And much of it is painful. Koheleth intends to put his sons on prickly ground so that they will have to use biblical wisdom to get answers. Koheleth does not answer these questions immediately, preferring to incite us to the same level of frustration he experienced. Well, we the church as well, brothers and sisters, we have much to learn from this. This indeed is a handbook, if you will, on dominion. And we have great opportunity to seize the truths taught here. They're experienced by all men. It's universal. This can be evangelistic for us. We can point to the land and the Lord above the sun as well. You'll not only have opportunity in Ecclesiastes to relish and wisely employ this life under the sun, but also use the very vaporous nature of this life to win and attract the lost to the gospel. We have an opportunity to point beyond the natural order, which we've covered today, that is under the sun, to him who dwells above the sun. Let's keep in mind that this is very much the agenda of Solomon, and it's all done with a proper application of godly wisdom. We will learn a bit of the nature of that wisdom as well. There is one who does dwell above the heavens, always remember this, who dwells above the sun. Give ear, O heavens, as we read earlier today, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew. Once again, vaporous, right? Let gentle rain upon the tender grass and showers upon the herb. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord. Ascribe greatness to our God, the rock. His work is perfect. For all his ways are justice, a God of faithfulness and without iniquity. Just and upright is he. Come to this enduring one today. Let us now taste a permanence with the vaporous elements that point to him, as we taste the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.